Support for Sound Ideas comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology, the best hearing device center in the Pantograph Reader's Choice Awards for the sixth year in a row. And now BNA welcomes Dr. Kristen Johnson to their team of audiologists. Dr. Johnson earned her Doctor of Audiology degree from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and her personal experience with a movement disorder adds a relatable compassion that fuels her passion for helping others. More information about Dr. Johnson is available at bnaudiology.com. Bloomington Normal Audiology, here for you.
You're listening to Bloomington Normal's public media. Hospitals that treat COVID patients aren't the only healthcare facilities strained for space and staffing during the pandemic. Lori Round, Chief Nursing Officer for Carl Broman and Carl Eureka Hospitals, and Elizabeth Angelo, the CNO for the Carl Health System, tell Eric Stock facilities sometimes can't move a patient to a long-term care facility or have to turn away a COVID patient from a rural hospital because there's no room. Here's Elizabeth Angelo.
And we certainly want to be able to do that. We want to be able to offer that care to hospitals who need us to help with patients. So one of the things we're looking at doing is getting creative around our patients who need that next spot to go to after their inpatient admission. We're finding that oftentimes it's difficult to facilitate a discharge to a nursing home or an extended care facility because they're also experiencing staffing and space challenges. And so not so much difficulty that's resulting in us transferring patients out, but more so that we haven't been able to say yes to all of the patients that we'd like to be able to care for.
And what happens in those cases?
So they have to call another hospital and seek another facility to care for them. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're seeing across the state is that as every hospital deals with increased space and staffing challenges, there's just fewer resources overall to meet the needs of patients in our region. And so that's one of the reasons why Lori and I, together with our teams, are just working every single day to create additional capacity to help meet the needs that are around us.
And Lori Round from Carl Broman, what are the biggest challenges that the staff face as they go through this to maintain not only to be healthy, but to still have the focus and the energy to sustain this for such a period of time? I could imagine that it can be especially stressful and physically and emotionally taxing over an extended period of time.
Well, yeah, it of course is. Getting in and out of PPE is not very fun all day long. Believe me, it's hot, it's hard. So the staff is doing well. So you have to be very careful. You know, when you do your assignments, you don't overload one person with a whole bunch of COVID patients, right? And they're in one section, and you get people, rotate them out so they're not always taking care of those patients. So everybody is competent to take care of the COVID patients, and then they rotate through those physicians. So it's not so taxing on just one group of individuals.
As we come up on the holiday season, you know, many college students are back home. They're going to be home for weeks. Then you have Christmas and New Year's. What concerns you most at this point as this season arrives and winter sets in and people are going to be cooped up for weeks?
You know, my concern is that people are going to get together over the holidays, and 2 weeks later, we're going to see another uptick in our COVID admissions. I think Dr. Healy from Carl Foundation said we'll see an uptick sometime around the week of Christmas, and then again after the new year, and then it'll, you know, and then again in March. So it's kind of going in waves, because whenever there's a holiday, people get together, and if they don't follow the precautions and the guidelines, then the downstream effect is that we've got more people with COVID who have been exposed, and our hospital feels the impact of that.
We are cognizant that at this point we're all so weary of the pandemic, and I think it's taken such a personal and professional toll on everyone. We know that there are just very real mental health challenges that go along with the isolation and the reduced social contact. And we don't in any way minimize how difficult that is for people. And we're hoping that our communities can find new and creative ways to connect with each other and to be in touch with loved ones virtually, even if we can't be together face-to-face right now. But certainly, as Lori mentioned, that is a concern going into the holidays. We can't let our guard down yet. I think hope's around the corner. We're so glad that there's a vaccine in development that is promising, but we are not yet to the point where it is safe to gather or to do the things that really could potentiate spread to a significant degree.
That's Elizabeth Angelo and Lori Round of Carle Health with Eric Stock. Carle Broman plans to roll out its new at-home program soon. It enables patients with mild COVID cases to track symptoms from home. Patients get tools to monitor oxygen levels and other vital signs. Carle Health has nearly 100 patients enrolled in the program system-wide. OSF Healthcare has a similar program. Carle also recently started posting daily COVID data on a new online dashboard. It lists COVID hospitalizations at each of its hospitals and intensive care units. Carle has had 106 patients die of COVID complications since March. Angelo says she hopes those numbers will help convince more people how serious the coronavirus is. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. At least 27 people have died, and more than 100 older veterans and staff at the LaSalle Veterans Home have caught COVID-19. Other veterans facilities have not had such a hard hit from the pandemic. Republican State Senator Jason Berrickman says a deeper dive needs to happen.
The facts that have been reported suggest that there is a special circumstance at the LaSalle Veterans Home that we're not seeing elsewhere in the state, at least in other veterans homes. It's a unique circumstance that requires a deeper look. There's been a lot of attention placed on this as a result of last week's hearing, but last week's hearing didn't really resolve the fundamental question of why are we seeing unique numbers there that we're not seeing elsewhere. In fact, the Director of Veterans Affairs for the Pritzker administration suggested that these are just trends that, you know, are being seen in LaSalle County or in the community. And I think at first blush that looks not to be the case. I think we need to do a deeper dive there.
Governor Pritzker has suggested that the proper place is his own inspector general. Is that the place for it to happen?
I think we need an independent review there, Charlie. I think the public, to be certain that there's some transparency in what's occurred, suggests that we need an independent review, some third party that the public can have confidence in that is going to be above the fray in terms of making political assessments and political calculations, and instead just, focus on what occurred, what we know, and what conclusions can be drawn from that. I think an independent review is the manner in which we get the answers that people are asking.
What budget cuts do you think need to be made, and how deep do they need to go to balance the budget now that the income tax amendment to the state constitution proposal failed?
There's three parts to this equation. One is tax increases, which Pritzker proposed, the public rejected. One is cuts. I think that is a conversation we will certainly embark upon in the spring legislative session. But the third one, which gets no attention from the Pritzker administration, is how do you make reforms that allow our economy to grow, put people to work, grow our job base and our tax base as a result. I mean, that conversation hasn't even gotten lip service from the Pritzker administration, and I think it's critical. I think that the public wants to see us make those types of reforms. They want to see the state grow its economy. They want to see people moving here and job creators moving here, and that is a really important conversation to have. Governor Pritzker, thus far, all he's wanted to do, he's angry that his tax increase didn't pass. He's lashed out at the public. He's threatened that he's going to decimate state government. But again, I think the public wants more on the reform side. I think the public is willing to do more when they see that the government acknowledges the work that we need to do. And thus far, they're not seeing it from Governor Pritzker.
Any reforms will take years to cycle into the economy. What do you think ought to be cut in the next year or two or three? And to even assuming that reform conversation or economic growth conversation happens, there will need to be steep cuts before then. What should those be?
I fundamentally disagree with the notion that reforms take years to enact. pension reform, which has often been discussed, not by the Pritzker administration. Pension reform is an example of a reform that is necessary. I think the public recognizes it's necessary, and there can be an almost immediate result from that. I think there's more that we can do to make cuts within Medicaid. We've seen expansive growth to Medicaid. It's probably the largest single expense of the state. When the state adopted the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare, the belief then was that the federal government was going to reimburse us for all of the liabilities or costs that we incurred. The federal government's not doing that to the level that they once did in any way, and we continue to incur those costs. We've expanded Medicaid greatly. I think that's an area that you can look to. I think the entire bureaucracy of our state government continues to need a look and overhaul. I think the public expects us to do that. Bottom line is that there ought be no area, that no stone left untouched as we look at where we can cut the budget.
Many Republicans continue to be silent about who won the election and efforts by President Trump to undercut the legitimacy of the election. Does that harm our body politic?
Yeah, I don't think it's helpful, Charlie. I think that we have an election process. It's the democratic process. It relies on millions of people casting votes around the country and having confidence that the outcome yields a winner for which the public and the world can have confidence on. So I believe that President Trump has had ample opportunity to present facts and evidence in courts of law. And thus far, we've not seen that from him. And that duty, I think, rests solely on him to bring forward that evidence and bring forward the facts that suggest something other than what we're seeing. What I see is that that Joe Biden won the presidential election. The transition is in process, and I think President Trump needs to recognize that. It's past due.
State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington also says Democrats have a tough road ahead deciding who will be the next House Speaker and whether it will be the scandal-clouded Mike Madigan. Berrickman says Madigan will not go quietly. He says no Democrat has stepped forward who is a viable option, and most of the Democratic House members have remained silent and must be presumed to support Madigan, even though he doesn't appear to have the needed 60 votes. Berrickman says the decision on the speakership will affect a wide range of issues at the forefront of the spring legislative session, including navigating the pandemic, deciding how to distribute vaccines, passing ethics reforms, and wrangling the budget. Berrickman says he hopes Democrats pick someone Republicans can work with. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Public Library patrons would see more parking, meeting space, and a pharmacy-style curbside pickup window if a scaled-down $20 million expansion plan comes to fruition. There would also be a new maker space, a new space for teens, a room for sensory-friendly visitors, and for nursing mothers. Library Director Jeannie Hamilton tells Ryan Denham this latest version doesn't have many frills, but it does give the library flexibility for curveballs like the pandemic.
As we were talking with the architects, the board really listened to feedback from the community that we want to connect to the downtown area. It's an area that the city has focused some efforts on, and we are very close. And so we want to reopen our Olive Street entrance. That was the original entrance to the library, was on Olive Street. And then as time evolved and parking became more of a transportation mode, then the building flipped so that the parking lot side was the main entrance. But so we've really worked with the architects to try to make the building feel a bit warmer too. Right now it is built in a brutalist architecture style. So that's a lot of concrete. So bringing in some warmer tones with wrapping the building with some wood and some natural elements. And most of the addition would be on the west side of the building. And so that's where we would have a lot of ability to add glass and those warmer tones. And so you do see as you come from like the downtown area, an entrance right on the northwest corner. And that would bring you into our what's currently our upper level. And that would be the adult services area in this new design.
So if this comes to fruition, you're going to have a lot more meeting space. My understanding now is you have one kind of major meeting room with about 100 positions or 100 seats. And this new plan, you'd have three rooms with up to 300 seats. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of flexibility that would give you, including for like traveling exhibits and all sorts of stuff?
Sure. So right now we do have the one meeting room. It's really heavily used both by library programs and then community use as well. And so this new design would be one big room that would sit 300 seats, or there'd be dividers that could make it into three rooms that are about the size of our current room. And then we also plan to have the ceilings taller so that we could have maybe some traveling exhibits. For example, the Smithsonian is a popular one that has traveling exhibits that goes throughout the U.S. And we just can't do that right now because we don't have the space. And so it'd be really neat to do more things like that.
And then on the outside of the building, what would be happening with like curbside pickup and book drop and those types of like quicker low contact type things?
Yeah, so we would have a space for a book drop still. We have that currently, an exterior book drop, but we would be able to fit in an automated sorter. So right now when you drop off your books, they aren't checked in for a while, but this automated sorter would check them in right away when you do that external book drop. And then right next to it, we'd have a curbside pickup. And it'd be like a pharmacy style window where you push out a drawer and people can grab their materials from that drawer. This is something that we had heard some interest in curbside pickup before COVID, and COVID, a silver lining of it is we found a way to make it happen in our current configuration. And we're hearing that people want it to stay. But we could make that experience even better than it is now in our makeshift format.
So you're sort of in an interesting position. You're in the middle of a pandemic, but you're planning a physical space where people will congregate. You know, so you're like planning for a future that, you know, it feels very far away, even though like presuming vaccines stay on track, it's not that far away. What is that like for your team to be like planning for this world that doesn't like exist right now, but you know it will be soon?
Well, one of the things that we've really stressed when we've done this planning process is the flexibility. So we want the space to be flexible and future friendly. So the space, we want to be able to shift our furniture around. So say this happens again, where we have to shut down and people have to be 6 feet apart. We want to be able to have the flexibility to be able to move spaces around so people can still enjoy the library, even in a pandemic format. So really looking at that, being able to adapt quickly as things evolve and as the library needs and desires change. There are some things that we do. I really strongly feel that people are going to be so hungry to gather again when we can, that we want to have a solid space where people are able to do that.
This would be about a $20 million expansion project, and the library has saved up enough on its own to cover more than a quarter of that cost, leaving about $15 million or so that the taxpayers would be paying for through bonding or debt. I know expansion has been talked about at all sorts of different scales and sizes and scopes over the last several years. How did you arrive at this scale?
Yeah, so we really heard the feedback in the past that the number we were coming in with was too high. So we really tried to scale back. This plan does not impact anything south of Jackson Street, which is where the Citizens Convenience Center is. So that would still stay and there'd be no cost impact there. This cost is all in, and it does reflect inflation over the next year before we would have be able to start construction. So we think this is a very true and accurate number. And it's we try to scale back and really listen to that feedback that we had before.
That's Bloomington Public Library Director Jeannie Hamilton speaking with Ryan Denham. Library leaders recently made their pitch to the Bloomington City Council. If the council signs off, construction would begin in April of 2022 and take about a year and a half. A group of Bradley University students is participating in a challenge to help NASA's goal to put astronauts back on the moon. Joe Deacon reports.
Bradley's BU Earth team has been chosen for the next phase of NASA's SUITS program to design and develop interactive spacesuit interfaces that could be used on the Artemis mission. Zach Bachman is a senior computer science major and serves as manager and director for the 10-person interdisciplinary undergraduate team.
So basically, think of it as almost like how you envision Iron Man suits with like all these projections that he can see while he's in the suit. That is sort of the type of thing that they would like to do with their new spacesuits. So what we're doing is we're helping basically like guinea pig their design process.
The Artemis mission's plan is to have the first woman and next man walk on the moon by 2024. While Bradley's team has participated in previous suits competitions, faculty advisor Heather Ford says this event is particularly challenging, but also very rewarding.
Each time students do this, some element of what they have created goes into the actual astronaut suit, which is pretty amazing.
Bachman has been on the BU Earth team since his freshman year. He says he is very passionate about the future of technology.
Space travel is obviously one of the biggest things, and to know that I'm a part of that is extremely significant. To be able to say that I have touched something that is likely going to go into space, or I've been a part of the creative process of something that will be sent into space, is exhilarating.
Selection for the challenge puts Bradley in the same company with such universities as Harvard and MIT, and Ford says those other teams feature mostly graduate students. I'm Joe Deacon.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.